Afghanistan's Kabul airport reopens as the Taliban looks to resume commercial flights there. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. 200 people, including American nationals, were flown out of the Afghan capital yesterday. With another evacuation flight scheduled today, Qatari officials working with the Taliban say the airport is now up and running weeks after the last American troops left the country. The BBC's Yogita Lamai has more on that story.
At the moment, only special chartered flights are being operated. The Taliban say regular commercial flights will restart soon. But for that to happen, there will need to be clarity on who will handle the security of the airport. Qatari officials say they're talking to the Taliban about this. A batch of relief supplies from Qatar and Pakistan has reached Afghanistan. The UN says there's a pressing need to deliver humanitarian aid across the country.
That's the BBC's Yogita Lamai reporting there. Well, this week, the Taliban announced its new cabinet, which includes some senior figures notorious for attacks on U.S. forces over the last two decades. Today, the director general of MI5, one of Britain's top intelligence agencies, told the BBC Afghanistan's fall to the Taliban is likely to have, quote, emboldened so-called U.K. terrorists. In the 20 years since the September 11th attacks, cities across the world have enacted a number of counterterrorism measures to protect their citizens. Many of those measures we pass by every day on our way to work or to grab a cup of coffee. Mark White, head of Resilience, Security and Crisis Management at consultancy Control Risks, told me how city planning has evolved over the years.
Within the UK post 9/11, there was a lot of government policy and support provided and information on how to protect urban centres, how to protect buildings from terrorism. Very much focused around the use of barriers, the use of bomb blasts, glazing and similar.
Have we gotten better at incorporating that design now two decades on? Because I think there are many cases now that we don't even realize some of these measures are even there. I think one of the examples that I was surprised to learn about even just yesterday is at the Arsenal soccer stadium here in London, there are big letters that spell out the team name. And it looks really cool. It kind of looks like a piece of art at the stadium, but actually it's there for security reasons.
You're absolutely right. If you look at the Arsenal Stadium, is a very good example of that. We use other techniques such as hard landscaping, water features. You'll see street furniture, seating or similar, really to try and make a secure environment. If you look at Heathrow Airport or indeed at any of the other modern airports, the areas around the front of the terminal buildings, vehicles are kept well away from the terminal frontages by long runs of bollards, and people perhaps don't realize it. They're being dropped off and they've got to walk across some space over to the terminal buildings. That is all designed to keep vehicles away, to keep threats away. Those sorts of bollards are combined with blast resistant glazing on the facades of all of those structures, but hugely expensive to install.
Do you think that these kinds of measures will be a staple for, decades to come? Because I think if we sort of look at where the security threats are coming from, we have a lot of this infrastructure now, but increasingly the threat is coming from hackers and sort of online platforms. So is there a need for this stuff longer term, do you think?
When you build these things in, I'm talking a lot about anti-vehicle measures because perhaps they're amongst the most visible. I mean, they're expensive to install and be more expensive to remove. And once the hard landscaping is put in around buildings, those are not going to change. Once you've put in bomb blast glazing, again, pretty unobtrusive, but you're not going to change that. But trying to keep up with evolving and emerging threats is a real challenge for designers. When we design a building, we're expecting that to be up for 50, 60, 100 years or more. And trying to predict what the threats to that might be in 5, 10, 15 years' time, that's a really difficult thing to do. As soon as you put in place one measure, people will look for a way to circumvent it.
Mark White from Control Risks, thank you so much for breaking all of this down for us this morning.
You're very welcome.
A quick check of the numbers now. Stocks across Asia ended largely higher today. Hong Kong's Hang Seng rose 1.5% after yesterday's sharp losses. That's after Presidents Biden and Xi had their first phone call in 7 months. The pair discussed a need to ensure competition does not veer into conflict between the two nations. Well, in just more than 2 weeks, Germans will vote for their next chancellor to replace Angela Merkel in the most uncertain federal election in decades. And climate change has become one of the top issues, as the BBC's Rob Young reports.
Germany recently held a remembrance service for more than 180 people killed in July's heavy rainfall and devastating floods. Daniel Koller's family restaurant was destroyed by the flooding.
It was a nice little place which is totally destroyed and in a historical building which will not be able to rebuild again.
The flooding has pushed climate change to the heart of the election campaign. Germany's dominant political force for almost two decades, Angela Merkel, is stepping down at this election. That makes this race special and unpredictable. In the first of several televised election debates, the three frontrunners to be the next chancellor discussed various issues on RTL television. They all promised to set Germany off on the path towards carbon neutrality, where the country no longer emits more greenhouse gases than it captures. But there are real policy differences.
Guten Abend, Herr Laschet.
The leader of Angela Merkel's CDU party has called for renewables to be made more reliable before coal power plants are turned off in 2038. The Social Democrats leader wants all electricity from renewable sources by 2040, and the leader of the Greens wants to phase out coal 8 years earlier than currently planned. But do any of the party's policies on climate go far enough? Karen Pittel is a professor of economics at the University of Munich.
No, not in my mind. Mostly they're lacking detail. They're saying which type of policy they would use to give more details. If it's about subsidies, then it is about, for example, carbon taxation. But it does not really form to a clear picture. So in my mind, it's probably good if we have a coalition so we get something from the one party and something from the other.
Germany's political system means some sort of coalition is likely. The election takes place at the end of this month. I'm the BBC's Rob Young for Marketplace.
Well, as Germans prepare to head to the polls, pack your bags because we're taking this show on the road. Producer Stephen Ryan and I will have live coverage from Germany starting 2 weeks from today. We'll delve further into how climate change is reshaping the political and economic landscape there. And we'll chat with business owners helping power the engine of Europe's biggest economy. For now, in London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.